content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the July 2021 Walter Magazine. We begin with the feature article. After decades of neglect, one neighborhood led the charge to revitalize a park built for Raleigh's black families in Saving Chavis by Courtney Napier. When John Chavis Memorial Park opened in 1937, it was truly a celebration. Over 3,000 people arrived at the lush 24-acre attraction for its opening, and the excitement in the air was palpable. Music from the Wurlitzer organ inside the handcrafted carousel mingled with the laughter of children. Splashes rang out from the pool as teens dropped into the water like cannonballs. Black men, women, and children, dressed in their Sunday best, ate bountiful picnics on colorful blankets, bright like wildflowers on a field. The park was immediately embraced by not just Raleigh's families, but families from across the Piedmont region. Sundays were for after-church picnics. During the week, young people played sports like baseball and swimming and watched band practice in the evening. Saturdays were for dancing. Despite the joy it brought to guests, Chavis Park was less a gift and more a mandate. As racial segregation became more prominent after the turn of the 20th century, Raleigh City Council no longer wanted black residents visiting the existing Pullen Park. They saw the creation of a new park in the black side of town as a solution to rising fears of race mixing among Raleigh's white residents. The saga of Chavis Park mirrors the story of the American South. It encompasses the promise of emancipation and the horrors of Jim Crow. It contains the complicated history of progress through the Works Progress Administration, WPA, program, and nearly 70 years later, the Hope Six Project. And on June 12, Chavis Park started a new chapter of its story, one that honors the resilience and perseverance of the black community in the face of it all. Looking to dig the country out of the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt created a massive infrastructure and jobs program entitled the Works Progress Administration. Cities desperate to employ their residents and fund languishing projects implored the administration for help, and in Raleigh, white politicians and residents believed they needed a separate park specifically for the city's black residents. The Negro Park, as Chavis Park was referred to during construction, broke ground in 1936. On July 4th of 1937, the park celebrated its grand opening, but the black community had already begun to make the park its own, starting with the name. Earlier that year, a group of black residents petitioned the Raleigh City Council to hold a contest among the community to choose the name of the new park. According to the National Historical Registration Application, quote, the Negro Citizens Committee of Raleigh, North Carolina, petitioned the city of Raleigh to rename the park for John Chavis. John Chavis was a free black man born in Oxford, North Carolina. He fought in the Revolutionary War and then became a minister, teacher, and activist, opening several schools where both black and white children learned throughout Wake and Orange counties. The park's connection to Chavis was a strong signal to the city about how black residents wished to be seen, liberated, accomplished, intelligent, and empowered. Despite its complicated origins, the park was embraced by black North Carolinians from Raleigh and the surrounding counties. None, however, enjoyed the park more than the residents of the South Park neighborhood and the families of nearby Chavis Heights, Raleigh's oldest public housing project. Eventually, however, the changes to society reached the beloved park. After the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which banned segregation and other race-based discrimination, cities all over the South that had invested in, quote, separate but equal facilities, now felt there was no need to fund those spaces. Parks like Chavis and the communities they held together began to fall into ruin. Like many predominantly black neighborhoods and towns across the country, disinvestment in public dollars in parks, the closure of many black public schools, and the expansion of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Wilmington Street took a toll on the South Park neighborhood. In the 1990s, after decades of neglect, the federally backed Hope 6 project demolished the Chavis Heights apartments to make way for new mixed-income housing. Families that had lived and played in the community for generations were displaced. Many never returned to the area once the reconstruction was complete. The people who had enjoyed the park the most were gone. In 2007, longtime South Park resident Ms. Frances Lynette Williams was informed by a Raleigh City Council member about the city's plans for John Chavis Memorial Park. "Have you heard about the plan for a new aquatic multiplex?" the former councilman said. The city had commissioned a study to determine where it could build a new state-of-the-art aquatic center, and Chavis Park was a top contender. "Say what?" replied Williams in shock. She followed with one of her signature expressions, "Nuh-uh," and that was the beginning of a community effort that would stretch out for over a decade. She brought the issue to her community through her neighborhood association, the South Park East Raleigh Neighborhood Association, or SPURNA, and they, along with the Central Citizens Advisory Council, petitioned the City Council about their aspirations for the park. The group wanted to see the park restored, much like the city had done over the lifespan of neighboring Pullen Park. A public leadership group composed of community members, including Frances Lynette Williams, Mary Brooks, and Virginia Talley, was appointed by the City Council in 2012 and worked together for 2 years to revise the John Chavis Memorial Park Master Plan. 2 years after SPURNA's first efforts, City Council voted unanimously to adopt the new Master Plan. In the spring of 2016, another victory, Chavis Park was added to the National Register of Historic Places, which ensured that it will remain a permanent fixture in the city. Finally, in September 2019, the city broke ground to begin construction on the first phase of the park's renovations. The June 12 reopening of Chavis Park introduced phase one of construction. The renovations included a state-of-the-art community center, artistic homages to the neighborhood's past, an elevated walking track, basketball courts, event spaces, and a new playground with a splash pad. The Carousel House, home of the original carousel and organ, has been renovated. It's now a community rental space equipped with a warming kitchen and restrooms. The next phases of the park will include the return of the swimming pool, and a dedicated center to honor the history of John Chavis, the park, and Raleigh's black community, entitled Heritage Plaza. Many of the community members who used the park in its heyday will be able to enjoy it again now, and their effort towards its revitalization will make it available to the next generation, too. "It is awesome," said Williams. "All of our hard work paid off." After catching her breath, she took it all in, the homage to the past and the facilities of the future. This article was edited for Time. From the History Vault, we have Leaves of Change. Two diminutive porcelain artifacts spill the tea about North Carolina's revolutionary roots, by Hampton Williams Hoffer. These days, we're all about coffee, but 3 centuries ago, it was tea. A staple of the colonists' trade with England, tea anchored social gatherings and served as a sign of refinement, particularly among those who delighted in its lavish accessories, from hand-decorated teapots to Chinese export cups and saucers. But 2 porcelain caddies, embellished vessels used to store leaves, on display at the North Carolina Museum of History, represent a lot more than just the tea culture of their time. It all started with a wealthy Edentonian named Penelope Barker. Her 3rd husband had sailed to England in 1761 and was unable to return for 17 years due to the British blockade of American ships. While she was in charge of their estate, the drive toward independence was growing in the colonies. Patriot leaders encouraged women, the main consumers of retail goods, to boycott British imports. Baker took it to heart, making the rounds of Edenton, garnering support from local women for a boycott of British tea and textiles. On the afternoon of October 25th, 1774, 51 women in Edenton gathered to sign a resolution. They were fed up with foreign rule. Their document, printed in the colonies and sent to England, stated that they would, quote, not promote the ware of any manufacturer from England until such time that all acts which tend to enslave our native country shall be repealed, end quote. They even signed their real names in this bold protest, which later became known as the Edenton Tea Party. It was the first significant political movement in this country staged by women. The History Museum's largest exhibit, The Story of North Carolina, traces 14,000 years of our state's history through all sorts of media, dioramas, interactive features, and artifacts. Beginning with American Indian life and moving through European settlement, museum visitors reach the story of the American Revolution. There, behind the glass, sit 3 relics from the Edenton Tea Party. The first is a large punch bowl dating back to the 1760s that was owned by Winifred Hoskins, secretary of the Edenton Tea Party. The second 2 are caddies, one of which may have been owned by Penelope Barker, and another that belonged to Lydia Bonner and Mary Bonner Blount, mother-daughter signers of the resolution. The caddies were used to store tea leaves, an exceedingly expensive indulgence. Hot water would have been brought up from the kitchen to make the tea, and caddies like these would have resided in living rooms, witnesses to the important business of patriot women. The petition of the Edenton Tea Party, while applauded in the colonial press, was the object of mockery across the pond. In the NCMH hangs a rendering of a cartoon published in the London press depicting the women of the Edenton Tea Party with masculine faces and loose morals. It's a great piece of political satire, says chief curator Raylana Poteet. It really lets you know what men of that time thought about women taking this sort of action. Barker was progressive, outspoken, and brave. It's no wonder that she's the same woman who assembled 50 others to her cause. As she wrote, quote, we cannot be indifferent on any occasion that appears nearly to affect the peace and happiness of our country, end quote. At NCMH, visitors continue through the story of North Carolina. The legacy of the women in the Edenton Tea Party paves the way for other firsts for women in our state. 100 years later comes Mary Jane Patterson, a free black woman from Raleigh, who became the first African-American woman in the United States to receive a Bachelor of Arts degree. Another 100 years after that comes Susie Sharp, North Carolina's first female Superior Court judge. The timeline of intrepid women in our state's history marches on. Barker and her comrades won't soon be forgotten, thanks to the meticulous preservation of relics that help us understand and relate to the past. The legacy of the Tea Party is alive and well in Edenton, says Chris Bean, who has held supervisory responsibility over the Penelope Barker House. But the real legacy is the pride that everyone feels in the bold political action of these women, so far beyond imagination in their time. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the theater section, History Reimagined. America's Oldest Mystery Gets a New Look, Life, and Vision by Gary Pierce. A drive that takes less than an hour from the Outer Banks can also take you back 434 years, back to America's beginnings. You start the drive on North Carolina's Outer Banks, cross over the causeway to Roanoke Island, pass through the town of Manteo, turn off the main road into the dark woods along the Sound, park and walk through the trees. It's evening, nearly sunset. In the quiet, you hear only the wind and the water. You're standing where, in 1587, a band of English colonists abandoned a tenuous settlement they'd established less than a year before. They set off in search of a new home, and then they disappeared. Today you can sit in an open-air theater where, on summer nights since 1937, the colonists' story and the mystery of their fate have been brought to life by the Lost Colony, America's oldest outdoor symphonic drama. Last summer, the production was canceled for the first time since World War II due to the pandemic. This summer, the Lost Colony is back, with fresh energy, fresh casting, modern production techniques, an updated script, and a new musical score. Now it offers another perspective at what might have happened when two cultures, English and Native American, came into contact and conflict. The play itself is a historic dramatization. It began as a federally funded Depression-era project when the theater was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps. The Lost Colony was intended to be a one-year production. Then-President Franklin Roosevelt attended the show with a good deal of media fanfare on August 18, 1937. After FDR's visit, the crowds followed. The show was so popular that organizers decided to stage it every summer. Last season's cancellation in the pandemic was a financial blow to the Roanoke Island Historical Association, which produces the drama. But having the break wasn't all bad, according to Kevin Bradley, the association's board chair. We had the time to reimagine the production, recharge our batteries, and refresh how we tell this story. The association also recruited a new director-choreographer, Jeff Whiting. My goal is to honor the history of what occurred here on Roanoke Island and to honor the legacy of this important theatrical work, says Whiting. Whiting added new theatrical devices to support the narrative, including large-scale puppets, a military-style drum corps, and a new symphonic score. The show also now features traditional dances from both Native American and English historical cultures. The Historical Association reached out to Chairman Harvey Godwin, Jr. of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, and with the tribe's help, recruited Native American actors and dancers. We're appreciative of the Historical Association's desire for accurate and historical representation, says Godwin. With North Carolina's American Indian population numbering more than 100,000, it enriches the production to see and hear their voices on stage. We want to give our audience an exceptional evening's experience in an outdoor setting, an experience you can't get many places, says John Ancona, the play's general manager. Ancona hopes that visitors will leave the theater intrigued by the story, Perhaps they'll dip into the ongoing research and archaeological exploration that still seeks clues about the lost colony. Where did they go? What happened to them? We don't know, but we do know that the colonists dreamed of freedom. They dared a dangerous ocean voyage. They sought a new life in a new land. Take the drive back to their world. Walk where they walked. See and feel what they saw and felt. Hear their story and feel the mystery of the Lost Colony. The Lost Colony will be performed through August 21st. For more information, visit thelostcolony.org. This article was edited for Time. Next, Amber shares tongue-in-cheek take on promoting America's natural treasures in Below Expectations by Addie Ladner. I don't claim to be from anywhere, says Amber Scher. The daughter of a Navy chief, Scher and her family spent much of her childhood on the move. By the time she entered high school, Scher had lived in Italy and 5 different states, and family trips took her all over the country. A road trip across the southwestern United States brought her through the Grand Canyon, Zion National Park, Yellowstone National Park, and the Badlands National Park. For Scher, these national parks became home. These visits were timeless, everlasting, grounding experiences to her. Parks solidified a vacation in my mind, she says. Scher studied graphic design and fine art at the University of Nebraska. After graduation, she landed a job working full-time in Raleigh at a design agency, but she began to crave a creative project of her own. As a professional designer, you don't get to draw. I wanted a side project that was a creative outlet for me and pertained to my interest. She thought about all those national parks she visited over her lifetime and started sketching them on her iPad. Soon she had retro-style illustrations of places like Joshua Tree National Park's desert landscape and the Grand Canyon's rocky ochre horizon. But she wanted text on her illustrations, something to identify them, something other than the park name. She stumbled across a perplexing 1-star review of a national park on Reddit that had her laughing out loud. Quote, "Save yourself some money. Boil some water at home," end quote, said one visitor to Yellowstone, a landmark that spans 3 states and is home to the world's tallest active geyser. That became her aha moment. This review was too good not to do anything with, she thought. Soon, she found other strange yet hilarious reviews. "The only thing to do here is walk around the desert," said a guest of Joshua Tree National Park. These 1-star reviews were the perfect amount of words to add to the bottom of her illustrations. "You might not notice the words at first. It's just a beautiful landscape," Scher says, and she chose the reviews strategically. "My focus was reviews that have to do with the experience of nature. It's about people being underwhelmed by nature. Most people think that's hilarious," and indeed they do. In December of 2019, she shared her illustrations on Instagram with the handle @subparparks, and they went viral. By the spring of 2020, sites like Reddit, BuzzFeed, Boston Globe, and Insider found the juxtaposition between these natural wonders and under-enthused reviewers as hysterical as she did. Soon, people wanted her illustrations to hang on their walls and send to their friends, so she created an online shop with things like stationery and posters. Scher left her full-time job in March of 2020 and has since focused solely on the Subpar Parks project and other creative gigs. Her book, America's Most Extraordinary National Parks and Their Least Impressed Visitors, debuts this month. It shows her illustrations of 63 national parks, with 13 additional national monuments, seashores, lakes, and national recreation areas. As a nod to her resident state's diverse and awe-inspiring state parks, resting on mountains, sand dunes, and dense forests, Cher illustrated a North Carolina series of subpar parks just for Walter. For example, along the Outer Banks in Nag's Head rests Jockey's Ridge State Park. It's a vast rolling dune, the largest dune system in the eastern U.S., with vantage points as far as the eye can see. But to one visitor, it's, quote, sand, but nothing else. At Hanging Rock State Park, a mountainous region known for its waterfalls and spring rhododendrons, another visitor found that trees obscure the view. Cher's illustrations are a reminder of how lucky we are to be surrounded by incredible state parks and recreation areas in North Carolina that encompass mountain balds, waterfalls, massive dunes, and lush forests. Use them as inspiration to get outside this summer and reconnect with nature. This article was edited for Time. And lastly, click into a classic pastime just a few miles outside of downtown with The Need for Speed by Anne-Monique Clarr. A few miles south of downtown, off Fayetteville Road, a gravel road leads through a stand of trees. Beyond, a gentle loop leads to a grassy parking lot. Metal bleachers loom ahead. The air smells like funnel cake and burnt rubber. And a few bucks will get you beyond a chain link fence. That's where you'll find the Wake County Speedway, a NASCAR-sanctioned track that draws legions of racing enthusiasts to its stands for weekly events, spring through fall. As the sun sets, the bleachers fill with families, groups of young folks with cases of beer or coolers in tow, old-timers with stadium seats and blankets to ward off an evening chill. Returning guests match their noise-canceling earmuffs to their outfits. Newcomers can buy them at a stand. The show begins before the races even start, as groups of cars enter the track for a warm-up loop, then race through time trials to see who will compete. Like the fans, the drivers are young and old, male and female. Pretty soon, start your engines. The track roars to life. You feel it down to your bones. It's thrilling and mesmerizing. You leave humming with energy, trying not to lean too hard on the gas pedal on your way back home. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.